Good evening. Welcome to the Imre Lakatos Award Lecture. The Lakatos Award was set up by a very generous anonymous donor to... Not anonymous? Not anonymous in this case. That's wonderful. And this was the... what's anonymous and what's not. So the Lakatos Award was set up by the Latsis Foundation, and it's in honor of Imre Lakatos, who you all know is one of the 20th century's most distinguished philosophers of science and one of the LSE greats. The award was set up to encourage work in our field, philosophy of science broadly construed, which includes philosophy of the natural and social sciences, and to encourage and support work in the LSE Department of Philosophy, Logic, and Scientific Method, to support work in the department in part by bringing exciting and distinguished award winners here, like Patrick Soupies from Stanford University, who is the winner of this year's award for the book Representation and Invariance of Scientific Structure. Now, our department consists of 10 people. One is a specialist in logic and probability. One is a general philosopher of science. There are two philosophers of social science, one philosopher of economics, one person who specializes in decision theory and social policy, one in social and political philosophy, and two philosophers of physics, one of whom happens to be an expert on Bayesian decision making. Now, I tell you this about our department not to show off the department, but rather to suggest to the LSE a surprising way to save quite a lot of money. That would be to just fire all of us and instead hire Patrick Soupies. Let us begin with the logic and probability. Pat has made very distinguished contributions to thinking about probability throughout his life, and the book for which he's won the award has a great deal of probability in it. He wrote a good, fine, logic textbook, sort of intermediate textbook from which I studied, and I might say years later this is still paying off. I'm about to send a paper to the British Journal for Philosophy of Science showing that two of our very distinguished and prominent colleagues have an invalid proof in a recent issue of the BJPS, and I know that it's invalid and they didn't notice it because I studied from Pat's book and they didn't. Okay. As to general philosophy of science, the book which has won the award is a culmination of a long history of work in philosophy of science, which bears on, and methodology of science, which, and the book contains issues in both philosophy, natural science and social science, specifically with respect to social science. Pat's very involved there. When we were teaching together at Stanford, I went often to seminars that Pat ran with, on the one hand, the psychologist Amos Tversky, or with the political theorist, political scientist John Fairjohn, or the economist Ken Arrow. Pat at Stanford held, or I imagine still holds, because you retire but don't actually retire, appointments not only in the philosophy department, but he was at the same time a professor of statistics, a professor of psychology, and held an appointment as a professor in the School of Education at Stanford University, and he's made contributions in all those areas. He's also, I said we have two philosophers of physics in our department, he's also made important contributions to the philosophy of physics, especially in areas where probability is involved. One of the things that, I suppose I'm letting the cat out of the bag a bit, but one of the things that Pat often has said to me is that physicists don't really know anything about probability. They don't understand it, and it's on account of the fact that he does that he's been able to make these contributions to the... one of the major areas in which he's worked is, of course, in quantum mechanics, and you can imagine on these famous no hidden variables proofs and Bell inequalities that are supposed to show that you can't have hidden variables or actions at a distance. So he covers everything in our department, and a little more besides. I also went to seminars with Pat that he ran with the distinguished Kant scholar at Stanford on Kant's philosophy of science, and I think nobody in our department could cover that. He does made great contributions to education and to distant learning, and is currently working on brain research, which none of us do either. So it would be a very good idea, I think, to replace us all with Pat. He is, besides that, well, I suppose I should also mention some other things about his role in social science. I mean, for instance, he's a member of the American Philosophical Society, which is America's first learned society. It's not a philosophical society at all, as one might expect. It has only a few philosophers, and Pat is in the social science section of it. So he's not only distinguished in our field, recognized, but in others as well. And I think I might have mentioned that he's won 2 awards from the American Psychological Association for significant scientific contributions. Now, besides that, I can attest that Pat is a wonderful colleague. He's open-minded, generous, full of vitality, full of imagination, and very supportive of his fellows. And I think that's probably enough for him to get started on his Lakatos Award lecture. Pat?
Well, Nancy, that was more than enough. So, well, I really am at heart a dilettante, and that comes out from Nancy's too fine introduction. Anyway, it's a great pleasure to be here. I want to begin by saying that I'm probably one of the relatively few people in this audience that actually knew Emma Lakatos fairly well. I not only visited him here in London, but very early in his career, he spent a year at Stanford at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences with Karl Popper. And that's where I got to know him originally and saw quite a bit of him on California territory rather than here. But I also saw him a number of times here and enjoyed arguments and discussion, of course, with Imra and with Karl as well. A discussion meant an argument. So, I enjoyed those. I don't mind that myself. So it's a particular honor to me to receive the award this year. And it's a pleasure to be here and to talk about the ideas that are covered in a different way in the book. In the book, I try to give a fairly thorough discussion of a number of different representations in science and of scientific structures, and to give the details. In this lecture, I'll have the pleasure of skipping the details, so I'm not going to give any theorems or say anything that's really terribly precise in a technical way. So I hope that what I'll be able to do is communicate my enthusiasm for the importance of concepts of representation and invariance in science. Sometimes, I think, not perhaps adequately represented in current philosophy of science. And I'll see at least what I can do to remedy that situation a bit. But I mean for you to sit back and enjoy this. I have only one or two technical remarks somehow I didn't quite squeeze out, and you can sort of look the other way as they go by rather quickly. Now, if I have everything in mind about how to, so that's the first step. There we are, yes. And I think that's pretty legible. So I titled this, The Importance of These Notions. So why representations? And it seems to me, this is not meant to be a detailed systematic argument, but one that hits the high points. There are 3 different kinds of things that immediately come to mind. Of course, we like representations for the purpose of external memory. Portraits, photographs are, of course, the most important ways that come to mind at once. We need reputations for computation. The history of measurement is the history of representations of a certain kind. And I'll give one elementary example. And some of you might say, well, why prediction? Well, if you really want to make predictions in a scientific and mathematical way, you need representations in order to do the computations for the predictions. And so I won't have too much to say about prediction, though it's dear to my heart, a topic not discussed enough and won't be discussed enough by me today. But, and finally, under a more general viewpoint, that of understanding. So a fine example of representation is the use of architectural plans to construct a building, to criticize it, to think about it, to change the design, etc. And then I take a couple of examples from physics and the atomic theory of matter. I'll say something about those in a moment. And finally, in fact, the biggest example that I want to discuss, partly because I learned it more thoroughly, I'm still a bit of an amateur, but I learned it most thoroughly in a seminar I gave with somebody else on saving the phenomena, the famous Greek phrase, last autumn. And the example I wanted to consider is the representation of the theory and conception of the heavens in Ptolemaic astronomy. I spend more time on that than anything else. But they're all meant to be fairly easy and fairly quick. Now, there is an important additional notion that I want to include here, and that is isomorphic. So I'm not interested in all kinds of representation, but I'll concentrate on a notion of representation that is important in science and in mathematics and in many places in philosophy. And that is that you want to have an isomorphism or a sameness of structure between the thing and the thing representing it, between the representation and the thing, in other words. And I say here isomorphic is equivalent to the same structure, but of course with respect to some set of concepts. Because if we took, I suppose, in that standard philosophical sense of all aspects of a thing, then the only representative of the thing would be the thing itself. And that's not the least bit interesting for the purposes here. So it's respect to some set of concepts. And it is, though, this sameness of structure that I want to be talking about. Now, I'll begin with, in terms of isomorphism, just to make some remarks of where art and science disappear. Here's a beautiful sketch by Horace Brodsky. And we immediately, all of us, recognize what he's attempting to represent here. I mean, and notice, of course, there are actually very few lines. It's done with great subtlety and skill. And yet we immediately recognize what it is about. The representation, we have an immediate response to. Why? Because there is an underlying isomorphism to the shape of the human body, in particular the female body. Now, art moves away from this very quickly. Here is something of a similar sort by Matisse. And again, we are able to recognize the kind of underlying isomorphism. This again is meant to be a sketch of a woman, but it's less immediately obvious, more difficult to see exactly where the isomorphism is to be found. And then here's a more extreme example of Paul Klee's moves us further away from what we might call anything like a realistic representation. Now, I'm not going to use the word realistic thereafter in any very serious way, but it's easy to use it here. Now, I said that this direction of movement of these successively further away from a rather complete isomorphism in these three sketches is opposite from science. That isn't quite correct, because we also have a direction toward abstraction in science that I'll not go into seriously, but it is in other ways an important aspect of representation. I'll say something about that. Right now I want to turn to the second example, measurement. And conceptual and particularly visual ideas about measurement are very old. These go way back to the Old Kingdom, something like that in Egypt. And of course, what I'm interested in here is the balance. It's very pleasing, having spent a lot of time in various parts of my life studying the theory of this kind of measurement, to find that it began so early. Here are other examples of that, showing how, and of course, the balance was turned out to be very important very early for all kinds of purposes. And it's placed just in Egypt, but it's easy to find balances in other civilizations of comparable age. Here's another example, and still another. Now you might say, well, okay, where do we go from here? Well, where we go from here is to now think about this balance, rather abstractly, in terms of, now we're going to think of, we just draw this crude diagram. We have an object A and an object B, and by the way the balance is tilted in this sketch, we think of the weight of A being less than the weight of B. And we represent that numerically by some function. So we have F of A, that meant to be the weight with some unit of measurement of A, and F of B, the weight of B. Now, this relation that I sketched there, it's not the same one he used. Yeah, I borrowed this nice, it's fun to use.
Well, it's just an ordinary pen, Pat, sorry.
No. I see that. This relation right here I've written, well, we already find, going beyond immediately anything to be found in the old Egyptian literature, partial axioms are given by Archimedes for balances with unequal as well as equal arms. This is in his treatise on the equilibrium of planes. Some of you who know the theory of measurement, the axioms look very much like some of the axioms of modern conjoint measurement. And surely the first place in the history of science that conjoint measurement is to be found. Conjoint because you take the two properties here, the length of the arm and whatever the weight is out at the end of it. Now the way it's done here, the axioms are done rather differently, as you can see from these sketches, which we also have for, this is what's called extensive measurement of mass or weight. This is when they're equivalent. And now we put two things over here. We put object B and object C. And so we can write it this way. A is equivalent to B. And we use star to say B star C means they go on the same part of the balance, same side. And then that star just corresponds, this is the isomorphism. Star is isomorphic here to addition of the numbers. And of course, this is what is the important intuitive representation of this kind of measurement, that the use of putting different objects to weigh on the same pan of the balance is like adding the weights, has the same properties that we can write down as addition of numbers. And the representation is very clear. We start with an empirical structure made up of just objects and relations, empirical relations between the objects. And then we have a second structure made up of numbers and the standard numerical relations and operations like addition, and then what we want to show formally, that as I put here, that if we take a set of axioms that we would have like the ones I started to write and won't write down here, then if we take all the models, including all the empirical models, then we have in the sketched out area here, in this part, the numerical models or numerical structures. And what we want to prove, for every empirical model of the axioms, there is a numerical model isomorphic to it. And this is there are endless things one does in measurement like this. And the setup I started with here is one of the simplest and easiest to describe. But from the purposes of the discussion of examples, I emphasize it is really characteristic in all its important features, with 105 different representation theorems about measurement, both in the natural sciences and in the social sciences. Now, it is also characteristic of measurement in terms of representation that it, the explicit theory of it has tended to be more popular in the social sciences than in the physical sciences, partly because there have been controversies about what you can measure in the social sciences. A very typical idea is a dispute in economics as to whether you can have what is often called a cardinal measurement of utility, as opposed to a merely ordinal one. A is more valuable than B, or A has greater utility than B. Whereas if it's cardinal, well, the typical way of saying that is that you have a numerical measurement up to the fixing of a unit and an additive constant, or in more technical, familiar language, up to a linear transformation. Now, there's a lot of controversy about that. I mean, it's easy to state what the formal theory is. The question is, do you have reliable means of measurement? And secondly, if you measure utility, can you talk about measurements that are comparable between different individuals? So you can have cardinal measurement for each individual, but no comparability between individuals. And all these are problems of exactly how you fix the representation. So, and I'm not going to explore those in detail, but the kind of apparatus that I'm discussing here and trying to give examples of is very well illustrated in that very large and complicated literature. Complicated now because of its size, and as the subject has been investigated empirically, complications turn up. Now, I said that as I turn to the other part of computation, measurement certainly is for the desirable for computation. If I were doing, I would have had 10 lectures, and I could spend 2 or 3 on measurement. But it'd be interesting to trace the way in which these numerical representations first came about. In the early days, in the very early days, in ancient Egyptian times, it wasn't recognized that you could use numbers, exactly the same numbers, for different kinds of things. It took a while for that abstraction to come out. Now, the second kind of computation I mentioned, requiring representation, is computation. And I just make some remarks here about this very familiar model, familiar particularly from physics, of having physical measurement of observed phenomena. You have numerical representations of the measurements as initial and boundary conditions, as in astronomy or anywhere else. Third, you have dynamic differential or difference equations, which are derived from an idealized theoretical model of the phenomena. And fourth, equations solved analytically or numerically by computation with given initial and boundary conditions to compute predictions. And notice there aren't any very complicated predictions you can make about the world without having representations that enable you to do computations. Perhaps the nicest example we see more and more of every day are computations of the weather. We have increasingly complicated theoretical models, that is, representations of the weather, all idealized, of course. Even with the best effort, still very idealized. But with those idealized representations, less and less idealized, we're able to get slightly better, hopefully increasingly so over the years, predictions of the weather. And as the saying goes, mostly now, progress in those predictions of the weather depend upon ever better computations, more extensive computations, using the next best supercomputer on the market. It's one of the best places for the use of supercomputers. Now, in the other parts of physics, I'm stressing, of course, in the case of prediction, we must have a representation we believe in, we think is going to work, and we use that for computation for the purposes of making predictions. In other cases, we have understanding. And I want to turn to a familiar example of that. In 1913, Bohr made a famous proposal of the Bohr atom with discrete energy levels, which came to think of this way as a kind of atomic solar system. Here's a nucleus, here are electrons in orbit around that. Now, it wasn't long before people said, well, that isn't really correct, of course. It isn't really quite like that. And with quantum mechanics, well, we can't talk about these detailed, precise orbits this way. Well, there's a lot to be said about that. And what I want to do is just read you one remark about it. I think it's very, very correct and very suggestive of what actually happens in physics. And this is a remark from David Bohm's beautiful book on quantum theory, published in 1951. Now, he just did some computations with the Bohr model, and then he says, this result is just the radius of the first Bohr orbit, the smallest one I had there. The argument is not exact, but only qualitative. Yet, it shows how we can make a picture that gives roughly the right results. This picture is very useful in guessing approximately what happens in a complex atom, where calculations are either very difficult or practically impossible. And I think that Bohm has it exactly right there. Here we shift completely away from detailed predictions. In fact, detailed predictions are very, as he says, extraordinarily difficult. But we get, from the representation pictorially, very suggestive ideas, even though we know those ideas are not exactly correct. And I think it's this is the right place to make that kind of argument, where we're not trying to prove a theorem about Bohr's concept of the atom. The right place to emphasize the importance of such pictures. Here's an equally famous, perhaps more famous, introduced by Feynman for elementary particles, quantum electrodynamics. Feynman diagrams. And Feynman diagrams are like the Bohr atom, enormously simple to look at. And you can't, from looking at this diagram, you of course can't do any detailed computations. So you have an electron right here, you have a photon coming in, so you have scattering, as it's, and the photon going out here, an electron recoil down here. Now, with the kinds of remarks about electrons and photons don't have exact trajectories in quantum mechanics, that's a mistake because of the Heisenberg principle, there's been often an aversion to drawing pictures like this. And one of the great things about Feynman was to push ahead with qualitative concepts that would help thinking about phenomena without offering the detailed hope of computation, but being extraordinarily useful for a different reason, of giving some clarity, some pictorial insight into roughly how the phenomena were behaving. Back of examples for which we use Feynman diagrams, the computations are often extraordinarily tedious and difficult. But the pictures help a lot. And so one of the theses here about representation is how good pictorial representation can be in many kinds of cases. Now I want to turn to the example that I said I would spend the most time on, and that's the famous example of Ptolemy. But I want to begin with Aristotle, because there's a lot of... Aristotle's more than 400 years before Ptolemy. And this is from Aristotle's Physics. Now, I'm going to give some passages from Aristotle and then go to Ptolemy, because 400 years later, Ptolemy picks up at the beginning of the Almagest the qualitative arguments that were begun by people like Aristotle and by other earlier astronomers. So we have now to explain that there may be an infinite motion one and continuous, and that this is motion in a circle. Everything that is carried along moves in a circle or a straight line, or in a line compounded of the two. And the important idea here is this infinite motion. And I'll give a few more examples, just to give you a sense of what of this idea of representation by this compounding. I just put in Euler's representation theorem, written a good many years after Aristotle. A rotation of a rigid body about a point is always equivalent to a rotation about a line through the point. You could imagine it being otherwise. And then a well-known theorem of 1830 that extends that. Aristotle would have felt quite at home with this. The most general displacement of a rigid body can be obtained by first translating the body and then rotating it about a line. Now, what is important here is this rotation, or the motion in a circle, or as they often will say equivalently, spherical motion. Now, here's another quote from Aristotle's second book on the heavens. The result we have reached is logically concordant with the eternity of circular motion, that is, the eternity of the revolution of the heavens. And this is, of course, the qualitative idea that is back of the much later substantial work of Ptolemy and some of the people preceding him. And that is that, first, the objects in the heavens are eternal. Second, their motion is eternal. Third, the only kind of motion that is really appropriate is that of a circle. And we'll add another word to that that Aristotle doesn't add here. It's uniform circular motion. Now, that language of uniform is also to be found in Newton. Uniform means that the motion around the circle has a constant angular velocity. That's the meaning of uniform. So we have a long history here of coming to the view qualitatively that this is the way we can think in a deep, fundamental fashion about the notion of how the heavens move eternally and without any change, repeating the same motions. That is, we have to reduce that motion, which phenomenologically is not a circle, to some composition of circular motion. Now let's look at what Ptolemy has to say in the first book of the Almagest. The Almagest was written somewhere between about 100 and 180 AD, a good many years after Aristotle. To sum up, if one assumes any motion whatever, except spherical for the heavenly bodies, so that means the motion is to be in circles, it necessarily follows that their distances, measured from the earth upwards, must vary wherever and however one supposes the earth itself to be situated. Hence, the sizes and mutual distances of the stars must appear to vary for the same observers during the course of each revolution, since at one time they must be at a greater distance, at another at a less. Yet we see that no such variations occur. Now, this is only a sample of Ptolemy's careful empirical arguments. I do want to stress that Ptolemy is really the master of detailed empirical arguments. The Almagest starts with excellent qualitative ones and then moves to even more excellent quantitative ones. Now, let me just give another sample for the same page at the qualitative level. So Ptolemy continues, the following considerations also lead us to the concept of the sphericity of the heavens. No other hypothesis but this can explain how sundial constructions produce correct results. And the sundial construction is discussed in much greater detail later. Now, something I will not talk about here. Aristotle and Ptolemy have a lot to say about the ether and why it moves like a sphere around a fixed point, which is the center of the Earth. Because for this discussion, what I want to say is, I want to abstract from the ether, just as one may abstract from Maxwell's physical models of electromagnetism, to his equations. And it's the equations, as everyone says, which turned out to be the really permanent contribution. To ask what kind of mathematical representation did Ptolemy succeed in establishing for the actual motions around the fixed Earth of the sun, moon, and the planets. Perhaps the most important representation in the history of science is Ptolemy's successful representation of these observed motions in terms of the composition of uniform circular motion on the circumferences of a small number of circles. Now, I emphasize two things. In this analysis of Ptolemy's, this beautiful analysis, starting with these qualitative ideas of Aristotle much earlier, the uniform angular velocity can vary from one circle to another. Secondly, the sense can vary. One circle may go this way, another circle may go this way, but always with uniform motion. There are two flavors of composition of circles: excenters, from which we get the adjective eccentric, and epicycles. Here's what an excenter looks like. Now, Eudoxus, much earlier, before Aristotle, according to legend, and probably approximately right, had some very clever ideas about using spheres, which then circles for trajectories, all going through the Earth as center. And it turned out to be seen fairly early by astronomers that wasn't going to work. So the first proposal here, let's say Z is the center of the Earth. The Earth is. So what we have to do to make the motion work, for example, of the sun, is to use a circle, but that circle has a center eccentric from the center of the Earth, which is supposed to be the center of the universe. So that's the notion of eccentric, of an excenter. Here, I have the word there. Now, the second idea is to use, instead of that, an epicycle. Here, the main circle is the circle with the Earth at the center. But then we add up here a smaller circle, is the epicycle. And you'll notice I've shown this one, this circle going this way, and in some cases in the epicycle, this circle, the small circle, may go this way. Now, a natural question of representation here: are excenters and epicycles the same thing? Are they in some sense mathematically equivalent, or are they different? Well, the answer was provided already about 200 years purely mathematically by Apollonius, and namely, they are equivalent. A very clever argument to show that for every epicycle, you have a corresponding excenter construction, and vice versa. Ptolemy gives, in the Almagest, a beautiful elementary proof, very explicit and detailed, of this equivalence. So Ptolemy's fundamental representation result is the following. The observed motion of the sun, moon, and five planets around the fixed Earth can be represented by the composition of at most three epicycles or excenters, but only the moon and Mercury require three. Ptolemy's saving of the phenomena by representation in terms of uniform circular motion in detailed quantitative and mathematical terms was the established cosmology for 1,500 years until Kepler. It was Kepler who showed that the Earth's motion is to be properly represented as an ellipse around the sun, with the sun at one of the foci of the ellipse. But what is important is, and it's partly an accident of nature that this works so well, the actual ellipses are very close to circles. And the observational methods available in Ptolemy's time were not good enough to make a discrimination between circles and ellipses. So that the theory, which we often have, informs it cannot be made to work. So we can have ideas about a subject, ideas that we think theoretically or metaphysically or for other reasons are very good, but they can't really be made to work in detail when they have this great simplicity that's proposed by Aristotle and followed up by Ptolemy and others, that you can have all the motion of the sun, the moon, and the five planets, the five known men, represented just in terms of this fundamental result. Now, what was important about that? That was deeply satisfying. Satisfying in a way that no other cosmology has been permitted to stick quite so long. And I also remind you that there is a sense in which we start from the framework of Aristotle and the other discussions of the eternity of the heavens. No further fundamental questions about the theory naturally arose conceptually. And that is in contrast to Newton's system of the world. Because in Newton's system of the world, he was not really satisfied with gravity as the explanation of the force producing the elliptical motion. He wasn't satisfied with gravity being the ultimate explanation. There are lots of passages that show his concern about something deeper is needed, of being uncertain that what appears to be an action at a distance theory could possibly be the fundamentally correct one. So I say that in terms of talking about representation in science, this is the great granddaddy of them all in terms of theories that lasted for an enormous amount of time. Now, of course, we can find Arabian astronomers in the Middle Ages that had various kinds of objections to Ptolemy. I mean, surely anybody working over 1,500 years is going to pick up some objections. But none of them were really fundamental. And Copernicus really continued also in the Ptolemaic framework. It was Kepler who's responsible for the change, and then a still more fundamental change by Newton in the latter part of the 17th century. Newton's Principia, you remember, was published in 1687. But my point is, and I think often not appreciated, I think especially among philosophers, there has often been a tendency to want to say, well, in ancient times, what's really important? Plato and Aristotle. There wasn't any serious science. Well, because I'm a late enthusiast, having read now, been reading Ptolemy very carefully, I have the greatest possible admiration for the combination of extraordinary mathematical clarity of the exposition in the Almagest, and at the same time, the extraordinary care with which observations, some of them going back for 800 years to the Babylonian astronomers, are carefully used in the analysis of data. In some sense, you have to really look around and think about it for some time to find in the modern literature of science a result that is as deeply satisfying as the Almagest is as an analysis of astronomy in the terms that I've set forth here, the terms of background that were accepted as fundamental. And that's why this is the granddaddy of them all, lasting for on the order of 1,500 years as a deep and serious theory of the motion of the heavens. So that's my favorite. Well, I spent longer than I should have. So I'll say something more quickly. I won't say as much about invariance because I have another favorite subject to talk about a bit at the end. Now, in art and in science, everybody is more or less familiar with representation. There's a lot less clarity about what does invariance mean and what is its usefulness in science. And so let me just try to make the case for invariance. You see, the broad structural view, of course, is that whenever you have a representation theorem in science, some phenomenon, or in mathematical theories as well, it's very natural to ask, what is the accompanying theorem about invariance? Now, not all areas will this be non-trivial, but measurement's a fine example of empirical applications where one wants to know the invariance result. So we mean by invariance something that's very natural, not varying, unalterable, unchanging, constant. But what do we think of as unalterable or unchanging? Well, the intuitive answer is a property of an object, collection of objects, or more generally some phenomena are invariant. Here are very simple examples, very important. Shape of a cup when moved around. So if I turn a cup upside down, sideways, the shape doesn't change. Those of you who know the history of the theory of physical space will recognize that as Helmholtz's famous claim, that we should derive the mathematical properties of physical space from being able to move a rigid object like a cup around with no distortion. A second aspect of invariance, important both in art and in science, is symmetry. Example close to us is the bilateral symmetry of the human body. And now I have some statement about this viewpoint of Klein that's more mathematical. I'll skip over that. Here's an example, though, a beautiful example from Cycladic art. Cycladic art goes back a long ways. It's roughly contemporaneous with the old kingdom in Egypt, about 2700 BC. And was produced in the Cycladic Isles off of Greece. What is wonderful is the marvelous symmetry and purity of Cycladic art. So it illustrates this bilateral symmetry I mentioned very well. Here's another of the same thing, to be found everywhere. I have a color version of this, but only on the overhead. This, so you can see that. The bilateral axis right down the middle here. And of course, here's the architectural case I was making earlier. And you recognize the architect, a very familiar Renaissance architect, Palladio, with his beautiful emphasis on symmetry. So, and you can see at the same time the usefulness of representation in terms of architectural plans. Now, I'm going to skip the formal definition of symmetry and just look at some examples. Here's a familiar one. Figures that are symmetric under all rotations, well, the circle is certainly the one that holds the prize here. So you can rotate any number of degrees and have invariance of the appearance of the circle about the center. If I take a square with a couple of diagonals, what's invariant here? Well, we can only rotate 90 degrees and not change what you see. So we have a group here, as we say, a group of four transformations just consisting of the multiples of 90 degrees. If we only have one diagonal, and then we have 180 degrees. If we only go 90 degrees, we can see immediately it doesn't have the same appearance. So here the notion of invariance looks the same. a very natural one. Now, these notions are useful in all kinds of ways. They're explored very thoroughly in classical geometry. So, for example, betweenness and congruence in Euclidean geometry, if we have betweenness and we have also congruence, if we want to look AB and then we rotate to an angle theta, then betweenness stays the same under the rotation, and so does the distance between A and B. So they naturally, AB is congruent to A prime B prime. On the other hand, when things don't work, we say, well, we can talk about invariance and meaning. Here's a familiar example, a little surprising in the history of geometry. Orientation, such as Aristotle's up and down, is not meaningful in Euclidean geometry. You know, Aristotle makes quite a thing of up and down. And what's surprising, in a way, there's no discussion of up or down in Euclid. It's not invariant, of course, as we'd say now in modern terms, under the Euclidean group of motions, rotations, translations, and reflections. But there's a very natural, in ordinary experience, a very natural notion of up and down. Now, if we move away from the Euclidean notion, in general affine geometry, for a comparison to be meaningful of two segments, they must be parallel. Now, I mention the affine because two important physical cases I want to mention them in are special cases of affine geometry. One is Galilean transformations in classical physics, and the other, the Lorentz transformations in special relativity. In projective geometry, we have something also very interesting, that although in general affine geometry, betweenness is preserved, it's not preserved when we project from one line to another through a point P of perspective. We use the notion of separation. So, for example, here. So here is the... There's the point P I'm going to of perspective. So I start with ACBD, and now I project starting at P, so I draw through PC, where it intersects this other line is C prime, PA, where it intersects, that's A prime, etc. Now notice, C is between A and B, but when I do the projection, C prime is not between A prime, B prime. So under this perspective projection, betweenness is not preserved. So we lose the affine properties. On the other hand, we have in projective geometry the notion of separation. The pair AB separates the pair CD, I claim, and we check that. And here is A prime and B prime. There's D prime there, and there's C prime out there. Separation works as we go, as I've written here, AB separates CD, A prime, B prime separates C prime, D prime. Under this perspective projection, separation is preserved. What is wonderful about that is that working out all the details of that is rather complicated. But it's absolutely essential to all kinds of human perception, visual perception. And we're very good at such projective view. And that's only the beginning of the complications in the real world. In the real world, the theory we want for representation is binocular vision. We don't just have a single point, but two points for the two eyes. But that's a story I'll not go into here. Now, physicists, in talking about invariance, and invariance, by the way, there are three big areas scientifically of invariance immediately come to mind. One is measurement, that I've mentioned. Second is geometry. And the third is physics. Physicists like to talk about objective meaning. And they mean something special by objective here. So let's look at the classical examples. In classical physics, the distances and times between point events are invariant for observers moving relative to each other with constant velocity. Now, in these examples, the way we play this game is that both the observers have the same measuring apparatus and have the same units of measurement. We can discuss the theory without that assumption, but it's simplifying. So they're measuring in the same way, but one's moving this way and one's moving that way with constant velocity. Well, in classical physics, then the times between two points observed, point events, will be the same for both observers, as will the distance between simultaneous points. And that gives rise to the classical Galilean transformations for moving frames of reference. Now, when we talk about preserving the time and preserving the distance between simultaneous distances and times, I mean distances between simultaneous events here. You'll have to add that. What is important, those are what are objective. What a given observer sees, though objective in the sense of he's using equipment, he's operating in an objective way, it is not objective in the invariant way, in the special sense of invariant. So, for example, typically, if I'm moving this way and you're moving that way, you will get a different measurement of the direction vector of some particle out here we're observing. So that direction vector will not be invariant, but the invariance will be as illustrated here. And what's important in a theory is to deal, in a physical theory, is to deal with the quantities that are invariant in this special sense relative to all observers. Now, in special relativity, we have to make only a slight change in this. So this will be a 2-minute lecture on special relativity. Because it's easy to state a very simple result.
If you lecture too long, Pat, you don't get your award, you know.
Okay, I see that, yes. So it'll be a 1-minute lecture.
Or you don't get the champagne, I'm not sure
which. Except the 1 minute. Now I'm going to really make this quick, because I do want 5 minutes for the end of what I want to mention last. The proper time, here is a particle moving, we call that an inertial particle because it's moving in a straight line. Here's a point and here's a point. And the distance between these, the proper time is defined this way. And what is and you can see the proper time involves time measurement and also space measurement. And what is important about this proper time is this is the invariant in relativity, rather than the separate time and the separate space between simultaneous events. And so from that alone and that assumption, given that you're measuring the speed of light the same way and the other measurements, this alone, without any other assumptions, just for the particle paths, the inertial paths, not two spatially separated points lying like this, that's enough to derive the Lorentz transformations. So now you have a quick sense of how they can be characterized. Secondly, this has a good adjective. This is a complete invariant, because only this invariant is needed to get the Lorentz transformations. No other assumptions about invariants are needed. Okay, how many minutes you give me? 3? I want to do one last example that's dear to my heart. It's something I'm working on. So here is a kind of structure of language. I want to talk, this talk is a quick one about, just to give you a sense of one way to think about how language is working in the brain is to talk about representations of language in the brain. And that's what I want to give you a quick lecture about, and being in the brain in the sense of isomorphic representation. So if we think of language, you can start with sentences. These are rough estimates of how many you encounter in a lifetime. I don't mind if I'm off by an order of magnitude, someone who's more silent or more talkative. Sentences, words, syllables, phonemes, see that's coming down, about 100 phonemes, distinctive features, so for example, voiced and voiceless would be an example of a distinctive feature for phonemes, only about 10. So you have a natural structure. Now the question is, much work has been spent on this hierarchy, in the study of language over the past 100 years. Do we have any corresponding structural isomorphism for the way language is taken in to the brain? Now, my answer is, the reason for taking the hypothesis seriously, it's hard to think about how the computations could proceed so effectively and so easily if there wasn't some kind of approximate isomorphism between what words look like out in the world and what they look like in the brain. And so what I want to do is give you a very quick statement about that. Let's see if this comes across. Can you read this handwriting of mine? Yes. This is kind of a last minute addition. So what I want to say here, many structural isomorphic representations of language already exist. Take the complicated sentence, John loves Mary. Well, we have at once sound pressure waves of speech isomorphic to printed words. These are meant to be, that's a representation of a pressure wave here. And the two sentence representations have a common grammatical and semantic structure. They're just a familiar, simple, context-free kind of tree analysis. So we have a lot of examples without going into the brain. I listed here some others. Cursive words, words written in phonetic alphabet, and then a very radically different thing, digital recording on a CD. Well, the isomorphism, the structural isomorphism, still holds there. But now let's go inside the brain. So here at the top is the recording of the spoken sentence. Albuquerque is the largest city of New Mexico. We have a lot of experiments using geographical sentences. And then after a lot of analysis of the recording of brain waves, which are generated in the electrical field of the brain, and you record by EEG, and after doing Fourier analysis, etc., here is the recording in the brain, the representation of that sentence. And there are two things here, a solid line and a dotted line. That's to show that we have a prototype and a test sample that look very similar. And in fact, we can do a classification test that yields very nice results on that. Now, you can, this is a recording of the sound pressure wave if you want. It's a pretty messy, complicated object, known, of course, for a long time. Not anything I'm saying that's new. It's just to remind you how complicated the actual physical nature of spoken speech is. So when we look for something internal, we don't quite know what to expect. Now you might ask me, is this meant to be the representation in the brain? And the answer is no, because I don't think there's going to be the representation, just as there isn't the representation in terms of spoken speech, of spoken words or sentences. You also have written material, written representations, etc. Same is going to be true in the brain. But what you do have is structural isomorphism that's easy to chart between these two. Here's another example. Berlin is not a city of Germany. That's meant to be false, of course. We balance true and false. Now, how are we going to dig a little deeper in that? This would be my final remark, but I'm doing this very quickly. A typical thing, by the way, let's stick at the level of speech for the moment, the pressure wave. It's not trivial to identify exactly where Berlin begins and ends, or where it not begins or ends. You can see why when you look at the graph of the pressure wave. Question is, can we go into the brainwave of such sentences and identify, slice out from different places, what is meant to be the same word? Well, here's an example I love because they look so similar. Here's the word east. This occurred like Berlin is not east of Moscow. And these are from two different sentences. This is after a lot of analysis of brainwaves. This is a picture now of two the brainwaves from two different sentences. All right? That helps the theory of some structural isomorphism here. Then here are some. We looked at 19 words in a whole group of these geographical sentences, north, south, east, west, and then a number of towns. And here are examples. The solid lines are the prototypes, the dotted lines are the test samples for Berlin, London, Paris, France, Moscow, and Warsaw. And these again are after being filtered, these are taken out of whole sentences in all cases. So we're doing a fairly good job of the first big step of identifying the words. Now you might ask, this will be my last remark, because I won't say as much as I would like to here. Ah, so you found the words. Well, maybe so. What about the phonemes? Can you find phonemes in speech? From speech into the brain? Might be more skepticism about that. Well, I just had more time. It's always a good line for the end of a lecture. If I just had more time, I would tell you the data about finding phonemes. So certainly my conviction is that we can move right down to the phonemes, and they can be found in the brain waves representing the intake of spoken speech, timed, the recording's timed right after that speech has occurred. So phonemes are to be found there as well. But, so you won't think I'm just giving you a story that really is going to be simple. I will tell you immediately a serious computational problem. An initial consonant, for example, like P or B, in the pressure sound wave only takes up about 20 milliseconds. The recordings we have in the brain's very slow in terms of processing speech, as far as we can tell. It runs along somewhere between 1 and 20 hertz. We need about at least 100 milliseconds, 150 milliseconds for an initial consonant. But you say, how can you have isomorphism of ba as opposed to, say, po? If you're going to go out there 150 milliseconds, what's going to happen to the vowel? Where does it get into the picture? Well, the answer is the representation, the isomorphism would stay, but the representation has to change. And there's a very natural mathematical answer that will work approximately well, maybe not so well when we get down to all the details. Namely, you move from being, here is P and here is ah, or ta, in the sound pressure wave, to having here is P and now superposed, here is ah. So you have superposition of the two waves in the case of the representation in the brain. But nobody ever said isomorphism meant really looks alike. It really has the same feeling. What's important, you must make that kind of change, but I think it's going to work out pretty well. At least I'm betting a good deal of time on that being the case. Well, I don't have time to summarize. I've talked too long, right, Nancy? Well, thank you.
Questions, comments? With you? Wait a minute for the mic, please.
I have a question about the cases of idealization that you have shown, such as Bohr's model of the atom. Since in those cases it seems that isomorphism fails to obtain between the model and the object that has been modeled, how would you go about explaining how representation obtains?
Well, you see, I'm using the word isomorphism here. Remember that, let's just take a simple mathematical example. So we have, for example, the isomorphism of two Euclidean figures. But now, if we say, are they topologically isomorphic, I can draw some pretty wild figures and say, yes, these are topologically isomorphic. They're homeomorphic enough. So when I say isomorphism, and I think Mr. Nixon used to say, I'm glad you asked that question, can clarify that some things I've said are as if perception is maintained, phenomenological perception, and I don't mean that. So you have isomorphism in this extended sense. And I think everybody recognizes that those kinds of approximate isomorphisms in physics, as it gets ever more complicated and messy, are very desirable, even though also recognized they clearly aren't exactly correct. They won't go through under the detailed metric you want for full prediction and analysis. You're not going to do computation, as I said, off of those Bohr-Adams pictures or Feynman diagrams.
Yes. Phil David. Sorry, okay.
I wondered if you had any comments on cognitive differences in processing isomorphic representations. And I'm thinking, for example, of algebraic or graphical representations of the same mathematical structure, which some people seem to handle one better and other people handle the other. And even in your own Ptolemaic discussion, there were these the eccentric and the epicycle representation, which far from obviously turn out to be identical, but
yes,
we have cognitive differences in processing them.
As Neugebauer says in his History of Ancient Astronomy, that was a beautiful piece of work on Apollonius' part to understand that equivalence. They don't look alike. Ptolemy's proof, by the way, is very clear of an elementary case. Certainly, I think there is evidence of real differences in individuals about, for example, the use of diagrams and the help that diagrams are for geometrical figures. So, I mean, I certainly know physicists who, at least in respectable company, would never touch draw diagrams. They might do it at home and not show them, but they wouldn't do that. Other people really live off diagrams. A great psychological importance to them. I am myself very keen about diagrams. I mean, I'm keen about diagrams in the way I like, even if I didn't do it as well as I'd like to here, this kind of lecture to give a lot of examples in a lot of diagrams, because I think we got so much complicated stuff going on now. If we try to write it all down in detail, we can't master to get a sense of a lot of things that are difficult to get a sense of. That doesn't mean the diagrams are enough, but they can be very important. Now, a topic, by the way, related to your question, is the history of the importance of diagrams in geometry. Everybody agrees that they have been important, yet they have a very tangled history in terms of preservation. You know, their importance is recognized. Now, let me mention finally, one of the things I'm interested in, I have a program for gifted students. We have a lot of data on elementary students learning elementary mathematics and geometry. And one of the things we find, you know, that classical conundrum about mathematicians, well, someone's an algebraist and somebody else is a geometer. But do these differences exist? And we do find systematic individual differences. They're not large, but they're systematic and they do maintain themselves across different types of problems. Meaning, one student will be better on the geometrical kinds of questions and looking at figures and answers, another will be better on the computational, but more or less the algebraic parts. I mean, I think those are real differences that people vary on. I'm not sure, I think that was part of your question.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Oh, sorry.
What do you think? Yeah.
Yes, that certainly agrees with my experience among mathematicians, that there are these cognitive differences to the extent that they often find it very difficult to communicate with each other.
Yeah.
Up on the balcony, please.
Hello, my name's, I'm up here.
There.
yes.
My name's Benjamin Bilski. I have a question, because what you showed about the structure of language from sounds or phonemes all the way up to discourse, and the experiments you mentioned, it seems, I'm just asking you whether I'm understanding this right, it seems that it will be possible to conduct physical experiments to settle some philosophic questions about the relationship between thought and language. So if you can map out and get the brain waves for the word London, if we test phonemes, so to go from law, 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 and see if that's a part of that, we're actually measuring whether our brain waves are representing thought or whether they're representing the representation of thought. So I was wondering what your views are on that. I'm not sure exactly if this is where you're going with your interest in this field, but I'm curious to know what your views are, where you'd like this to go, I guess, on the relationship between thought and language.
Well, I think that I didn't use the word thought to discuss it. It's for good reason. Would not have been thoughtful. The actual reason is that I think there's an important difference between the language we have come to use in Middle East, talking about thoughts, and any details that we're going to talk about with similar care in terms of the brain activity. So a way of putting it is, to take a related case, a similar answer, what about concepts?
Yeah, okay.
So let me give you one kind of, let me give you an experiment about concepts that was turned out to be a surprise. You remember that in the history of philosophy, the famous poo-pooing of Locke by Berkeley and Hume. Now, let's see, the general concept of the triangle. It can't be equilateral because it wouldn't be general. It can't be scalene because it wouldn't be general. What does he have in mind? Remember they have, particularly in the original sarcastic words of Berkeley, and then summarized beautifully in the early pages of Hume's treatise. And the answer they give a positive answer. Their answer is, there ain't no such general idea. So if you talk about triangles, they're annexed to a term, the term triangle. If you remember, that's the exact Hume's phrase, annexed to a term. Now let me tell you about the experimental data. So the experimental data, one of these things we came upon by accident, in a way. If we look, say we show a triangle on the computer screen, and we got subjects wired up. And now after we do it later, we give them the word triangle. Or we fill the screen, this is not Berkeley new, but they should have done this as well. We fill the screen with say the bright red color. And then later on we have the word red. Then we have the word blue, and then the word blue. What we found out is that what we get immediately in the auditory cortex, the first thing we get from the shapes and the colors is the word, the annexed to a term. That doesn't mean that we're reducing the concept of a triangle to the word triangle. I'm not saying that for a moment. I'm saying that the theory of how concepts are computed for me is in terms of an associative network. And the way you enter that network is by the term problem. But what is surprising is that instead of having some attempt to think of an abstract concept and how's it working, you immediately have some kind of answer just in terms of language itself. Now, there's a recent book published in psychology called The Big Book of Concepts. I don't know if any of you have seen that. It is big. And there are really three theories of concepts that's current among psychologists. One is just classical definition, familiar to mathematics and philosophy. That's accepted as the way it gets handled. The second is prototype theory. So when we see a cow, we have a prototype, and it's that prototype that we look at as its symbol. And third, the Berkeley-Hume theory, which is now alive and well, is the exemplar theory, it's called. So you have a label, a word, and you have these associated connections of the various instances to the word and to properties. So that's my answer. But my answer is, you see, if we want to think about the brain, much of Middle East doesn't work well in detail. And I'm not suggesting, like the churches, we stop using psychological terms. I think that's nonsense. But for the particular purposes of foundational research, we have to be very aware.
Thank you.
How about one last question here in the middle? Yes. Or remark?
Hello. If concepts were innately connected to verbalization, as you seem to be saying, how is it that quite simple electronic recognition systems can distinguish polygons of various descriptions and various degrees of obtuseness or whatever from each other. That surely, you know, being able to recognize a geometrical pattern is a very large part of the concept. So that on top of your three types of concepts, or the big concept man's type of concept, there must be a recognition concept that as it were, predates verbalization. Because obviously, if we believe in evolution, animals could recognize objects long before they could actually talk about them. Yeah?
I could agree with you more. But
which of the three concepts is it then?
What I want to say is, you see, that doesn't mean Barclay and Hume weren't right in some respect. That is, if I show you simple figures, the very first thing that happens with great speed is you associate to the name. Why? Because that's an organizing principle that takes you out to other things. You have a big, complicated associative network matter. Included in that associative network are exactly algorithms for computing various features.
But these are fuzzier than algorithms, aren't they? I mean, an electronic recognition system isn't necessarily an algorithm. Method.
So it's done very quickly. You know. But whether we want to call that an algorithm, another question. But certainly I agree that you have feature recognition that works very well as well. And you have, the question is something. A natural question in animals, what corresponds in animals to this quick association to the word? Well, there is one natural psychological response to that, namely a response. Animal makes a response.
But in doing so, does it not show possession of a concept independent of its linguistic?
I don't mind at all talking about shows possession of a concept. I think if you want to talk about how the brain does the processing, you want to use the word concept with great care. You can't say what you just said and think through what are the real details.
Yeah, I think that's what I was suggesting.
Can we stop the conversation on that note?
Disagree on.
And perhaps you can discuss it in detail, as one of Pat's favorite expressions. Before we thank Professor Soupies, I have one announcement. Those who are invited to the award ceremony, it's not in the senior dining room, but in the senior common room. That means it's in the room not where people eat their lunch, but where you sit around afterwards and drink your coffee. There's another reception in the senior dining room. But let's now take the occasion to thank Professor Soupies very much for his great book, his great career, and the nice lecture.
Oops.